tonight's lecture. I'm Ian Sloan, and I'm a local member of the Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East. And along with the Canadian International Council, we're sponsoring tonight's lecture. I'll just define that a little more clearly. Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, CJPME for short, is sponsoring the national tour of EID, and Canadian International Council is sponsoring the local event here tonight. So I'm here just to say a few words about CJPME. But before I get into that too much, what we're going to be doing is asking you after the lecture and before the question and answer to fill in a feedback form for us, CJPME. It's been important to us to be engaging with Canadians over issues, particularly with respect to the Middle East. And we would like to have your feedback and hopefully to have you connect with our national organization, which is up to about 40,000 adherents now across the country. So we'll be asking you to fill these in before the Q&A and give them back to me before the Q&A, and those that have agreed to help me do this. And then the Q&A, and after the Q&A, we will have a draw for a copy of The Ugly Canadian. So that's a little incentive, I hope, to fill in the form. So as for CJPME, we're a non-profit secular organization whose mission is to empower Canadians of all backgrounds to promote justice, development, and peace in the Middle East, and here at home in Canada. We do that by informing people, the public, and the media through speaking tours, such as tonight's exhibition, such as the Child's View from Gaza exhibit that's been around the city in the last month, and the Boycott Center on our website to act quickly and efficiently on an issue and to provide training and advocacy. So we do that because we want the voice for justice and peace to be heard loud and clear in Canada. So we really encourage you to join with us and help make that voice loud and clear in Canada. Among other things, we've been meeting with politicians, and in one of our initiatives, a delegation of 35 CJPME representatives met close to 40 members of Parliament in the last month. Well, those are a few things that we do. Our website is cjpme.org. Invite you to go check that out if you haven't already. And I want to thank you all for coming tonight and to ask Mark now to come up and to introduce both Canadian International Council and our speaker tonight.
Thank you, Ian. Hi, everyone. My name is Mark Williams, and I'm the president of the Hamilton branch of the Canadian International Council. The CIC is a nonpartisan organization that is meant to act as a democratic forum for participation in Canadian foreign policy, as well as to act as a think tank on global politics. And so tonight we have the privilege of welcoming Eve Engler back to present to us. Eve is, of course, one of our most important voices on Canadian foreign policy. He's been described as Canada's version of Noam Chomsky, and the author of a rather formidable list of books, such as Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping, The Truth May Hurt, The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy, Canada and Haiti Waging War on the Poor Majority, Canada and Israel Building Apartheid, as well as two other co-authored books, all of which he has displayed for us on that table. And he's here tonight to promote the release of his newest book, The Ugly Canadian, Stephen Harper's Foreign Policy. So it is my privilege and honor to invite Eve Engler.
Thanks, Mark, for that, and thanks for organizing this, and CJPME and Rabble.ca and Hamilton Coalition Stop the War, all for endorsing and organizing things at tonight's event, and thanks everyone for coming out. Some of you might have seen that about a month ago, our good friend Stephen Harper received a World Statesman of the Year award by a pro-Israel, pro-American Empire group in New York. It was an award that was presented to him by that wonderful man, Henry Kissinger. where Harper went out of his way to talk about how he admired Henry Kissinger's foreign policy, which I think says a lot about Stephen Harper's foreign policy. So a group of us in Ottawa decided to present Stephen Harper with an alternative prize, a different prize, the Richard Nixon Prize. So we actually had a press conference in Ottawa at the Communications, Energy, and Paperworkers Union's office, where we presented Harper with the Richard Nixon Prize for his principled, forthright, and steadfast international policies in the interests of the rich and powerful, regardless of the consequences. And so I did my best Clint Eastwood impression, and I put an empty chair with a little picture of Stephen Harper on it, and I explained why we gave Harper the Richard Nixon Prize. It was after a long and thorough analysis of his foreign policy. The granting committee was very impressed by Harper's position on Afghanistan. When most Canadians want the troops to return, Harper has stood firm and maintained Canadian troops in Afghanistan, maintained the Joint Task Force 2 that are involved in those nighttime assassination raids. When Parliament started asking these uncomfortable questions about Afghan detainees, Harper had the good sense to just shut the Parliament down. And so this is one of the reasons why we gave him the Richard Nixon Prize. The other part, we went into all areas of Harper's foreign policy when granting this award, more obscure areas. So for instance, the Richard Nixon Prize grantees applauded Harper's decision to send 2,000 Canadian troops to Haiti after an earthquake that killed hundreds of thousands. While other countries were sending heavy urban search and rescue teams, our government sent troops to secure order for Haiti's elite, when many other countries misguidedly focused on search and rescue teams to pull injured people from under the rubble. The main thing that the Richard Nixon Prize grantees, the main reason we gave Harper this prize was because of his environmental policy. His willingness to push back against those in Washington, in Europe, who were trying to dub tar sands oil as dirty oil. And Harper has, at international climate negotiations, repeatedly made the tough decisions to support more carbon in our atmosphere rather than simply accede to the overwhelming international consensus. So this is the main reason we granted Harper with the Richard Nixon Prize. And unfortunately, at our little event in Ottawa, Stephen did not show up. He didn't receive the award. We had a very nice award, a picture of Richard Nixon and, for him, but he sent his regrets, but he couldn't show up to our event. But in all seriousness, it's I think good to make light of groups that would give Stephen Harper a World Statesman of the Year award. But in all seriousness, what Harper's foreign policy has meant for people around the world is serious. It's the consequences are significant in terms of people's lives. And this tour, it's not just about launching the book, it's also a Stop Harper's Crimes Against Humanity tour, and there's actually stickers that we've produced about stopping Harper's crimes. I don't talk about these foreign policy decisions as mistakes or as errors. I talk about these issues in moral terms, and the consequences are very significant for many people around the world, and we should refer to these Harper's foreign policy as being responsible for crimes against humanity. So to go into the different issues about Canadian foreign policy under Stephen Harper, right now, as we're talking, Canada is in a low-level war against Iran. Right? That's not how most of the media refers to what's going on, but it is. That I think that's how it should be described. Right? The sanctions that Canada has against Iran's economy is designed to cripple the economy and to spur people to protest and to overthrow the regime. And when you try to cripple a country's economy, that sounds, you know, at the abstract level, oh, just trying to hurt their economy, what's the big deal? Well, what is an economy? That is people who are already poor, who already have difficulty getting milk, getting eggs, getting foodstuffs, getting that much more difficult for them to get those foodstuffs. The intensity of the sanctions Canada has against Iran are such that Toronto-Dominion has begun canceling the bank accounts of Iranian Canadians, people who are receiving pensions, maybe a couple hundred bucks a month, who worked their life in Iran and retired in Canada, so receiving a few hundred bucks a month maybe from Iran, or conversely, sending a few hundred bucks back to family members in Iran. That's the intensity, the degree to which Canada is trying to attack Iran's economy. Is you have Toronto-Dominion making that type of decision. Canada has naval vessels patrolling off the coast of Iran, running provocative maneuvers, right, alongside American armada, trying to elicit tension. Canada's occupying country bordering Iran, right, Afghanistan. We know there are Joint Task Force 2, Canadian Special Commandos, who operate in total secrecy, in Afghanistan. What is to say that those operatives are not also crossing that border? I have no evidence of that, but I don't think it's certainly shouldn't be dismissed without a little knowledge of the history. You have Defense Minister McKay telling the Toronto Sun in March that Canada's preparing, the Defense Department's preparing for an attack against Iran, for a full war against Iran. You have Canada cutting off its diplomatic relations with Iran a couple of weeks ago. That's usually considered the first step before, or the step before, a full-scale declaration of war. And this Canadian campaign against Iran is all under the guise that Iran is building nuclear weapons. That's the ostensible reason for attacking Iran's economy, denouncing Iran in every possible form. It's because Iran is supposedly building nuclear weapons. Well, we know that the National Intelligence Estimate of US government going back to 2007 concluded that Iran had stopped pursuing nuclear weapon program in 2003. That was reaffirmed in 2011 by the US intelligence. But even if Iran was pursuing a nuclear weapons program, the hypocrisy of the situation is a little bit much, right? Our American allies and Israeli allies don't have a possible nuclear weapons program, but have a significant nuclear stockpile today. Israelis have about 100 to 300 nuclear weapons. The Americans have about 5,000. The Americans spend $60 billion a year on a nuclear weapons program. That's four times Iran's entire military budget. Right? But the Canadian government, when Arab countries call for a nuclear-free Middle East, what's the Harper government's reaction? Right? It's to oppose International Atomic Energy Agency resolutions calling for a nuclear-free Middle East. Why? Well, our ally in Israel doesn't, again, have a possible nuclear weapons program, but has a significant stockpile of nuclear weapons. And the Harper government has worked to stop IAEA resolutions on a number of occasions calling on Israel to bring its weapons under the body's oversight. Shifting gears from Iran, the Harper government has militarized Canadian foreign policy in a pretty profound way, increasing the military budget from about $15 to $23 billion, massively increasing the number of troops, more than doubling the number of special forces, the Joint Task Force 2, Special Commandos, and other Special Commandos. And as I mentioned earlier, from a political perspective, the point of JTF 2 and other Special Commandos is the secrecy, right? It's the deniability in political terms. They can be sent wherever, and we have no idea where they've been sent, and there's no way of forcing the government to divulge where they've sent special commanders. So it's the secrecy of those operatives. And there's evidence to suggest they were, of course, involved. They are involved still in Afghanistan, and the plan is to keep them there after 2014. That's already been announced. And also they were involved in Libya, of course, during the NATO bombing campaign of Libya. The Harper government has set up plans to establish 7 military bases around the world, dotted a little bit all around the world, so the Canadian military can respond quickly to future wars, right? Permanent military bases with the plan of future wars. At the cultural level, here in Canada, they're preparing the population, building our support for militarism. In 2010-2011, the Canadian military spent $353.6 million promoting itself. And 661 staff members were devoted to promoting the military, to convincing us that we should support Canadian military operations. They changed the citizenship handbook, added a whole number of historical mentions of the military as a way of preparing new Canadians to buying into the pro-war message. And this is, these are just a few examples among many, many others in the cultural arena of trying to support increased militarism. And this pro-military policy is such that in July, the head of the military, Walter Nathanson, told the Canadian press, openly called for another war to the Canadian press. And so he told a Canadian press journalist, quote, "We have some men and women who have had 2, 3, and 4 tours, and what they're telling me is, sir, we've got that bumper sticker. Can we go somewhere else now?" That bumper sticker, that's what they refer to, war. Bombing other countries, occupying other countries. That's the military perspective. But the Harper government has pushed the pro-war agenda to such an extent that the head of the military can call for an open war, can call for a war openly, and there's basically no reaction. The opposition parties don't really say anything. The media commentators don't really say anything, at least critical. And this is a sign, this is an ominous sign for the future of Canadian foreign policy. So they're building, they're preparing the groundwork for future wars and quite frankly, endless wars. And that's of course something that their friends in CAE, in Bombardier, SNC-Lavalin, other Canadian corporations tied into the military production, of course, something that they very much support. Shifting gears again to the question of Palestine, and many people talk about many people are aware that the Harper government has an incredibly pro-Israel policy. Right? That's discussed now, that's probably everyone in the room has heard that at one time or another it suggested that Canada is the most pro-Israel country in the world, which certainly diplomatically is the case. But there's little discussion of just how extensive the support for Israeli policy is, and what that has, just to what extent that pro-Israel policy is. And so in the dominant media, there's basically no discussion of a couple issues that I'll get into on the question of Palestine and Harper's pro-Israel policy. One of which is the charitable funding. And the Harper government has made it completely legal for Canadian charities, registered charities, groups that have a special tax status that individuals who donate to those groups receive a tax write-off, as much as a third, 40% of the donation, that registered Canadian charities can support Israeli groups operating in the occupied territories, operating in the West Bank, supporting settler organizations, and they can continue to have their charitable status.
So even though those settlers, the settler groups and the colonies, the Israeli colonies in the West Bank, were deemed illegal according to international law, even ostensibly the Canadian government considers them to be contravening international law, you can receive a subsidy for supporting Israeli settlers in the West Bank. You can also receive a subsidy to work with the Israeli army. Right? A number of Canadian charities with charitable status work with the Israeli army. The double standard when it comes to Palestinian charities is pretty shocking. So while you can support settler organizations or the Israeli army, it's illegal, and receive a tax write-off from the Canadian government, it's illegal to support Palestinian groups or groups supporting Palestinian organizations that maybe support some orphans in Gaza or send a dialysis machine to a hospital in Gaza. And this was mostly at the theoretical level until about a year ago, when a Toronto-based Muslim charity, Irfan, had its charitable status cut off by the Canada Revenue Agency because it had sent a dialysis machine to a hospital in Gaza that happened to be overseen at some level by Hamas, because of course Hamas has been in charge of Gaza for about 6 years now, and the health ministry, of course, is operated, you know, the minister is from Hamas, and the hospital falls under the health ministry. So because they sent a dialysis machine to Gaza, and because they're supporting hundreds of orphans in Gaza, Irfan had its charitable status cut off. And the board members of Irfan continue to have held over their heads the possibility that they will actually be pursued criminally. Because according to Canadian law, organizations that are identified as in any way associated with terrorist organizations, and that's much of the Palestinian political spectrum, that's groups like the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, Hamas, and five other different Palestinian political organizations. If you're in any way associated with those organizations, even if you, again, send a dialysis machine to a hospital that just happens to fall under their authority, that's deemed supporting the terrorist organization. So the Irfan board members still have hanging over their head the possibility of actual criminal charges for supporting Gaza, supporting orphans, and a dialysis machine in Gaza. So there's incredible double standards between what happens to Israeli charities and Palestinian charities. And this is significant. This isn't without consequence. Canadians send hundreds of millions of dollars every year to Israeli charities. And you can find Christian Zionist organizations, you go to their website, Canadian Christian Zionist organizations with charitable status, who are openly calling for money to be sent to Israeli settlers in the West Bank. And they describe this in very biblical kind of terms. Another important Canadian support for Israel that gets basically no attention in the dominant media is something called Operation Proteus. Have people here heard of Operation Proteus? Some people? Not many? Well, it's understandable considering that the dominant media does not discuss it whatsoever, even though at one point it was considered Canada's second biggest military mission. And what it is basically a Canadian training mission, training a Palestinian security force alongside British and American military officials. And it's a Palestinian security force that is designed, according to Canada's ambassador in Israel, John Allen, quote, to ensure that the PA, the Palestinian Authority, maintains control of the West Bank against Hamas. So, going back to 2006, Hamas won elections overseen by Canadian election observers. The Harper government's immediate response was to cut off all aid money to the Palestinians. When there was a Palestinian unity government, the Harper government did all it could to try to wreck the Palestinian unity government, withdrew funding, refused to have any relations. Once that Palestinian unity government collapsed in mid-2007, Canada began a $300 million aid program to the Palestinians, five-year $300 million aid program. Most of the $300 million goes to Operation Proteus. And the goal is to support Fatah, one Palestinian political faction, against Hamas. That's the initial impetus of the whole operation, to support Fatah against Hamas, to basically spur a Palestinian civil war, which took place for a while and sort of continues at one level. The broader objective of Operation Proteus and Canada's training of Palestinian Security Force is to help oversee Israel's occupation of the West Bank. Because colonial authorities throughout history always want local officials to do as much of the security work as possible. So in India, it wasn't British officers and military officials that were the bulk of the security force overseeing Britain's occupation and colonization of India. It was, of course, Indians that did most of the security work, with British officials in the higher up positions. Israel's no different. They want Palestinians, compliant Palestinians, to do as much of their security work as possible. And the training force that Canada is building, the Israeli Shin Bet vets all the Palestinians who might join the security force. And the Palestinians are trained mostly in Jordan in a police training center that the Americans built after invading Iraq, and where they were training Iraqi security forces for a number of years. And to understand what this security force is all about, there have been a whole number of human rights reports that have shown that alongside the American, Canadian, British training of the Palestinian Security Force, the rights to freedom of assembly in the West Bank have deteriorated, right? To the point where Human Rights Watch has called on Western governments to have nothing to do with the Palestinian Security Forces. When there were solidarity demonstrations with the Arab Spring in the West Bank, it was the Canadian-trained security force that put down those demonstrations. Right? When there was demonstrations in the West Bank against Israel's bombing of Gaza in late 2008 through early 2009, it was the Canadian-US-trained Palestinian security force that put down those demonstrations. And there's been a number of recent examples of repression of the Canadian-trained Palestinian Security Force. And Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, his electoral mandate ended over 3 years ago. So what we're doing basically is propping up an unelected regime in the West Bank that's very much tied in and compliant in the face of ongoing Israeli settlement expansion, ongoing Israeli dispossession of Palestinians. And so I belabor the point just because you don't hear about Operation Proteus in the dominant media, and I think it's an important component of Canada's support for Israel's ongoing dispossession of Palestinians. Shifting gears briefly to a number of other issues, the Arab Spring, the Harper government's policy to the Arab Spring, support from Mubarak in Egypt to literally the final hours. Harper was making speeches in support of Mubarak's transition plan 3 hours before it was announced that Mubarak was actually stepping down. Support for Ben Ali in Tunisia right until the last moment. And alongside this support for dictators that got ousted by popular movements is Canada's support for the monarchies in the region, most notably the Saudi monarchy, right? Probably the most repressive anti-woman regime in the world. This is the Saudis who were behind funding so much of the most repressive social forces throughout the Arab world and beyond. And in 2011, the Harper government okayed $4 billion in Canadian weapons sales to Saudi Arabia. $4 billion. Second biggest recipient of Canadian weapons after the US. So while there were Saudi forces rolling into Bahrain, 1,500 Saudi forces rolling into Bahrain to put down the popular movement, the democratic movement there, those are almost certainly those Saudi forces were rolling in light armored vehicles built in London, Ontario, and after Saudi Arabia invaded Bahrain, the Harper government okayed many more sales of light armored vehicles to the Saudis. Over the past couple years, there's been about 6 or 7 ministers that have visited Saudi Arabia, including Ed Fast a couple of days ago, to build economic and political relations with the Saudi monarchy. Harper's anti-democratic policy is not just something you see in the Middle East, it's also something you see in Latin America. In 2009, when Manuel Zelaya, elected president of Honduras, was ousted by the military, Canada was one of the most ardent supporters of the change of regime. The only country not to cut off any of its aid to Honduras after the military overthrew Zelaya. The European Union, World Bank, even the Americans suspended some of their aid money to Honduras, the Honduran military regime. Harper government refused. Continued the military training assistance program, where Honduran military get trained in Canada with this new military regime. And this is a coup d'etat that led to hundreds and hundreds, probably into the thousands, certainly hundreds and hundreds of people being killed, ongoing, we still see the ramifications, ongoing murder of journalists, about 2 dozen journalists that have been killed in the past couple of years, targeted because of their reporting, against, or even their investigations of those forces that were behind the coup d'etat. And the Harper government was at the forefront in supporting that. Just by chance, Canadian mining companies like Goldcorp were not happy with Zelaya because of some of the changes to the mining code. And since the coup, there has been many Canadian officials that have been down there to help rewrite Honduras's mining code in a way that's more beneficial to foreign mining interests, mostly Canadian mining interests. More recently, another coup in June of this year, the elected president in Paraguay was ousted. Canada was the only country in the hemisphere to recognize the new government. Again, just by chance, Montreal-based Rio Tinto Alcan was in opposition, or had some tension with the Lugo government in Paraguay over subsidized electricity, multi-billion dollar plan to produce bauxite in Paraguay. And since the coup, the new government there has been more open to Rio Tinto Alcan's desire for subsidized electricity. So the Harper government's anti-democratic policy from Saudi Arabia to Honduras, you see examples of that. And that's why I think one of the common explanations that the Harper government gives for its pro-Israel policy is that it's the only democracy in the Middle East. And so if you're going to be a pro-Palestinian group, and you're going to respond to some of the absurdities that you hear, like, we support Israel because it's the only democracy in the Middle East, one of the best ways to respond to that is like, oh yeah, that's why we supported the coup in Honduras, that's why we supported the coup in Paraguay, that's why we support the monarchy in Saudi Arabia, because we really believe in democracy, right? I think that it's important to have a more holistic understanding of Canadian foreign policy as a way to respond to some of the absurdities that are sometimes thrown at those supporting the Palestinian cause. Shifting gears again, the Harper government has been an ardent supporter of
the Canadian mining sector. I'm sure most people in this room are familiar with some of the horror stories of Canadian mining companies operating around the world. The stories are many, many too many to enumerate. Pretty much at this point, you can pick any country in the global south, and you can find an example of a Canadian mining company that is involved in a ecologically destructive operation, or is spurring social conflict in the community. Pretty much every country in the world at this point. And the Harper government has been behind the mining sector, even though the mining companies themselves, there's a number of reports that have been leaked that are commissioned by the mining sector, Mining Association of Canada, admitting that the Canadian mining sector is sort of at the forefront of these social conflicts or spurring social conflicts around the world. And it's no surprise, Canada is home to more than 60% of the world's mining companies. Far and away, the main hub of international mining. And Harper's been at their back in numerous different ways. So when there was a bill put forward by a Liberal MP, Bill C-300, that would have reduced or eliminated public support for mining companies that were found to be violating human rights abroad or involved in ecologically destructive projects, Bill C-300 would have ended Export Development Canada's support for those companies, would have ended diplomatic support in the local countries for companies involved in dubious affairs. The Harper government voted against and defeated Bill C-300. Also, Harper, on numerous different international trips, has been at the back of Canadian mining companies involved in destructive projects. So not long after thousands of people demonstrated in Chile against the Barrick gold mine, Harper, in a visit to Chile, actually visited the Barrick Gold office in Chile and talked about how Barrick Gold adheres to Canadian corporate social responsibility standards. In Tanzania, at a Barrick Gold mine where dozens of people have been killed over the past few years, Harper made sure to laud Barrick Gold's activities in Tanzania. Similarly, in Honduras, in a visit to Honduras in 2011, Harper went out of his way to talk about the good things that Goldcorp is doing in Honduras, even though there was immense local opposition to Goldcorp's policies in Honduras. At the aid level, I'm sure many of you heard about the role that CEDA, the Canadian Aid Agency, has done in terms of shifting Canadian aid to supporting mining companies. Tens and tens of millions of dollars of Canadian aid being diverted to supporting corporate social responsibility projects that mining companies are operating. So you have basically the Canadian state subsidizing highly profitable mining companies that are trying to pacify local opposition with aid projects. Right. So the Harper government has increased strengthened the role of the Canadian state in supporting mining companies abroad. Certainly the most destructive element of the Conservative foreign policy long term is on the environmental front. Is their repeated opposition to international climate negotiations meetings. There are repeated attempts to sabotage international climate negotiation meetings. And they've repeatedly received the colossal fossil by environmental groups for doing the most to obstruct climate negotiation meetings. And this has to be seen in the context of where the Earth is going, where a recent report a couple weeks ago, a report commissioned by 20 governments suggested that as many as 100 million people could die because of climate change, or if we don't reduce, or should I say, carbon emissions over the next 20 years. Right? Already we're talking about 400,000 people dying annually because of climate disturbances. That's not Canadians. That's not us. I was just in Quebec City, and there are many places in Canada where a little bit of warmth would actually be, a bit more warmth would be nice. It's actually pretty nice and warm here. But that's not us that are the main victims. That's places like Bangladesh, Ethiopia. Ironically, some of the places that emit the least amount of carbon emissions, right? There's an unfortunate injustice there, where the generally the biggest carbon emitters happen to be in the environments that are least likely to be, being least impacted by increased carbon emissions. So the Harper government's opposition to climate negotiations, numerous UN international meetings on the issue, has been incredibly destructive for those modest, very modest attempts to reduce environmental catastrophe. But it's not just at these international meetings, which have received a certain amount of attention. It's at the day-to-day level. When governments in Europe, or the European Union, or the American government, or state governments in the US, have tried to reduce the amount of carbon emissions in fuel sources, they've received intense lobbying campaigns by the Harper government. So the low carbon fuel standard that California passed in 2007, that was supposed to come into effect in 2011, the Harper government has done all it can to block the tar sands from being defined as part of the low-carbon fuel standard. The fuel quality directive that the European Union is trying to adopt, the Harper government has repeatedly tried to undermine, I think, over 100 different lobbying sessions with European parliamentarians between 2009 and 2011 by the Canadian government to try to not have the tar sands included in the fuel quality directive. The Conservatives understand very clearly that the highly emitting tar sands cannot be, if you're going to be serious about reducing climate change, or you're serious about trying to bring in a low carbon fuel standard, that's of course going to have a major impact on the planned expansion of the tar sands, which they are hand in glove with the tar sands industry, of course. That's the Harper government's base in Calgary, very close relations with these different oil companies making immense profits from this dirty oil. So in the US, you have the United States oil sands advocacy strategy that the Conservative government is pursuing. According to Embassy Magazine, that is the main thing that the Canadian diplomatic apparatus pursues, is the energy file. Right? So, when a state government like Wisconsin discusses bringing in the low carbon fuel standard, Canadian diplomats go to present to the state legislator to try to block, to try to dissuade legislators from pursuing low carbon fuel standard. In California's case, Canadian government helped build a coalition of oil companies that has sued California to block it from implementing the low carbon fuel standard. And it had actually been somewhat successful. The legal fight has been somewhat successful. So the Canadian government, the Harper government, has been trying to build coalitions of oil interests within each country. And we have all the access to information on this, where they're, you know, trying to, the Canadian embassy in all the different European countries are working with companies like Shell, Total, Norway, Statoil, to build opposition to the Fuel Quality Directive, similarly in the US. And the extent of the lobbying campaign has led to some pretty harsh comments
by European and American political officials. So the head of, Finnish MP in the European Union, Satu Hassi, had this to say. There have been massive lobbying campaigns by the car industry, by the chemicals industry, banks, food giants, etc. But so far, I have not seen such a lobbying campaign by any state. That's in reference to the Harper government's lobbying against having the tar sands included in Europe's fuel quality directive. American congressional staffers referring to Canadian lobbying in the US, in Washington, as being like an aggressive car salesman. Right? So there's been this incredible campaign in Europe, in the US, against any attempt to bring in, to reduce the amount of carbon emissions coming from fuel sources. And this, again, has to be seen in the context of the possibility of human civilization being extinct, right? Runaway climate change, climate disturbances are already having significant consequences on millions and millions of people's lives, and the situation looks like it's going to be getting worse and worse and worse unless there is attempts to reduce the amount of carbon emissions in the atmosphere. And our government has been at the forefront of blocking any attempt to do so. And so when we talk about stopping Harper's crimes against humanity, there's no issue more pertinent to that language than the climate front. And I know I've been going on for a while here, so I'm going to move towards a conclusion. And the conclusion is, what do we do? If you agree with what I'm talking about, or you're unhappy with Harper's foreign policy, how do we stop it? Of course, I have no idea. I have a few suggestions. And I think a big part of it has to be, first of all, it's like any serious social transformation, it comes from below. It comes from social movements. It comes from popular power. Almost any change worth having, that's where it comes from. We've seen recent months the success of some of that just next door in Quebec, and the student movement in Quebec, the role they've played in shaking up Quebec society and winning the short-term victory in terms of forcing the government to getting the ending the tuition increase. So you see popular power, street power having success, and I think that there's no doubt that's the only way we're going to have any significant shift in Canadian foreign policy is if getting people active on these issues. And part of that, I think, has to be building cross-issue alliance. Right? There are groups working on mining justice, against militarism, in support of Palestinian rights, against Harper's environmental policy. But too often those groups just sort of work on their specific issue and don't see the commonality of struggle and don't really work together. And I think it's central, it's vital to see the commonality of the issues and the source of much of the policy. Part of what I hope to do with this book tour, with the 300,000 Stop Harper's Crimes stickers that have been produced, is try to get people thinking about these issues, not just singularly, but more holistically. And part of building a cross-issue network, I think one of the things that we might want to do, if there is some success with stickering campaigns, with bringing these issues together, is having a popular tribunal or people's commission on Harper's Crimes Against Humanity, where we bring experts on all the different issues to discuss detail the different issues. And ultimately, if there's success on that front, building a cross-issue network is actually targeting some conservative ridings
maybe half dozen ridings where they won by close votes, and having a negative campaign in those ridings where we discuss some of the destructive foreign policy issues. And that comes from a personal experience I had with a riding in Montreal, a negative campaign we ran, Haiti Action Montreal, against Pierre Pettigrew, the former foreign affairs minister, where we put up 2,000 posters in his riding with a picture of Pettigrew wanted for crimes against humanity in Haiti. This was during the 2006 election campaign. We handed out about 15,000 leaflets detailing what Pettigrew was responsible for in Haiti, and he was defeated in that election. And he, both La Presse and Le Devoir, mentioned the campaign that we had instigated, held rallies, demonstrations in his riding, etc. So I think there is possibility. There's probably some specific ridings with specific demographics that might be fertile to running this type of negative campaign, discussing specific foreign policy issues that might help in defeating specific conservative MPs. But more generally, we need to force the opposition parties to make foreign policy an election issue, and an issue. Right? We need to be putting pressure on the NDP and the other opposition parties to bring up these issues, not just go along with the conservative foreign policy. And the main way we're going to do that is by being active on this issue and making it clear to the opposition parties, mostly the NDP, that there's something to be gained on this. The Harper government, I think, part of the explanation of their foreign policy is he's playing to the most progressive sectors of the base of the Conservative Party. Foreign policy is the forum where he can throw the raw meat to the most progressive sectors with little electoral downside. Right? On the Palestine issue, for instance, people usually think of Harper's pro-Israel foreign policy as having to do with a pro-Israel Jewish lobby. But I think it's as much to do with the base of the Conservative Party of evangelical Christian Zionists who believe that all Jews need to be in the Middle East for the second coming of Christ and the rapture and, you know, end times. That's some of these sort of quite socially regressive sectors of the Conservative base are very much into this kind of thinking, and being pro-Israel is very popular with those sectors. And sometimes, you know, some of the conservative base, that the big issues they want, right? Abortion, gay marriage, you know, making it legal for a woman to have the right to choose. This is the main issues that some of the Christian base of the conservatives want. Those have electoral downsides for Harper. That's why he's hesitant on those issues. The Israel issue has much less electoral downside, but is also popular with some of the sectors, those sectors of the party. So we need to push the NDP and the opposition parties into seeing that there's an advantage. This foreign policy issues are sort of wedge issues for the Conservatives right now, and we've got to push in the other direction for the NDP to see some upside in taking on these issues and putting the Conservatives in a difficult position on these issues. But the thrust of what we need to do is we need to talk about these issues. We need to break through the dominant media's refusal to explain Canadian foreign policy properly, and we need to struggle, build the social groups, work with the groups that are already active on Palestine, already active on mining justice, and there are lots of groups, right? Here in Hamilton, across the country, groups like CJPME, like Mining Watch, the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, build these groups' efforts so, one, we can get rid of the Conservative Party, get rid of Harper, stop Harper, and two, we can have a future where Canadian foreign policy is no longer just about serving corporate interests and imperial interests,
but it's actually about making a better planet for everyone around the world. I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.